For the week of September 21st, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 250, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in the Shire, I'm Michael Giltz.
Why are you in the Shire now? Of course, the Shire refers to where the hobbits from Lord of the Rings come from.
That's right. It's because we're recording on September 22nd, which is Bilbo and Frodo's birthday. They share the birthday of September 22nd. How sad that I know it, and yet I do.
How sad that J.R.R. Tolkien, or Tolkien, I don't know, what is the correct way of pronouncing Mr. Tolkien?
I always say Tolkien, but what do I know?
Well, he created this entire fictitious, fantastical world and set it in with a calendar that has the month of September in it.
Well, it's different. It's not a straightforward calendar, but I'm pretty sure that that we can claim September 22nd as their birthday. But no, it is not exactly like our calendar. So there you go. But okay. 250, episode 250, what a nice round number. Here we go. Thanks everybody for listening. But while they're listening to episode 250, what will they hear?
Well, before I tell them what they're going to hear, I would just like to say that you can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can even call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263.
And if you leave a birthday greetings for Bilbo and Frodo, we'll pass them along.
That is true. We will definitely do that. Now, you asked what they're going to hear on this week's show. Later on this week's show, we'll be joined by Mark Berman, editor-in-chief for TV Media Insights, the entertainment industry's online destination for television and media news, and of course, all of those ratings numbers. Mark will be here to discuss all the changes taking place with television ratings, thanks to DVRs, video on demand, and so on. How many viewers watch a show when it first airs has become really less important than how many in total watch the show during the week that follows. Mark will fill us in on why that is. And as we enter the last quarter of 2014, it's time to start handing out prizes to some of the year's best fiction and nonfiction books. That's why the shortlist for the National Book Award and the Man Booker Prize have been announced. In addition, you might be surprised at who the number two retailer is in North America when it comes to ebooks. Normally, that's not important, but we'll give you a hint. They're named after a fruit.
It's always important.
Okay. Well, of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And we're talking about the box office around the world, not just North America, because around the world is where Hollywood makes its money. We base our info on RentTrak. We have a link to them in our show notes. They post worldwide grosses every week. We also pull information from Variety, Hollywood Reporter, the LA Times, anywhere it appears. And the number one movie around the world, yet another young adult dystopian novel, turns into a big hit movie, The Maze Runner, is number one around the world. It grossed $70 million over the weekend. It's also the number one movie in North America. Had a nice, solid opening. Not as big as the first Hunger Games or Divergent, but a good, solid opening. It's grossed $81 million worldwide. And as far as the filmmakers are concerned, it's a success because they didn't just pull in the chicks. The other films have leaned slightly towards women, and especially young women.
You mean other young adult type movies.
That's correct. The movies we just mentioned, like Divergent and The Hunger Games. This film, however, was more evenly split between men and women, and so they felt they pulled in the guys with emphasizing the action and the rough setting, sort of it's a Lord of the Flies type feel to it. So obviously the girls showed up as well because there are a lot of young guys in the film and it's got a nice action setting. So everybody's happy. And of course, there's a sequel.
Yes, well, that's because all of these young adult movies based on young adult novels, I like to say they have a beginning, a middle, and another beginning to each movie. They don't actually have an ending.
Well, this one in particular could have been a standalone movie. The story felt complete with the big exciting finale, which if you haven't read the books, I won't spoil. I really don't think the book is very good, but anyway. But then film two and film three have very, very different settings. They're not set in the maze as such. There's a whole world out there, and it's very elaborate and different. And creates a whole new set of challenges, kind of like the Golden Compass, the movie franchise that was to be that never happened. So The Maze Runner could have stood on its own and been pretty satisfying. So it would have been okay for them to say, well, we're happy, we made money, but we're not sure there's enough there for a franchise. But no, they're moving ahead. They got three books. I think it's three or four. And then there's spinoffs. And I'm sure they'll turn the last book into two movies. So that's going to already come out September of 2015. They've got a date. Now they just have to make it.
I didn't realize that this was a state secret that the film was already set for a sequel. I mean, I knew about that weeks ago because
It was not. It was not official.
Oh, okay.
No, well, they had not pulled the trigger. You know, they sometimes you see with TV shows and you see with movies. It used to be as soon as a movie came out or like a year later, they say, now we're going to make a sequel. Now it's like as the movie comes out, they're like, oh, what a hit. Now they want you to go to the first film. So they say, we're going to make another one. So to sort of solidify your anticipation for the first one, they let you know there's going to be a second one. Just like on a TV show, sometimes now they renew it for season two before season one has even debuted. You know, they just want to sort of double down on their bets, get you excited by it. They can always back out. I'm sure it adds complications to the contracts, but they can always back out. But in this case, they were not sure about the sequels, I think in particular, because they are very different. You know, they're not, it's not the same thing.
I would say it doesn't add too many complications to contracts because almost every film, even if there are ones that will never have a sequel, and you know going in, they will never have a sequel.
Like A Fault in Our Stars.
Right, exactly. There can't be a sequel because, well, I'm not giving anything away. They die at the end. That said, almost every contract has sequel clauses built into it so that if there is a sequel, it's already in. Much like they have clauses for the star having to appear at the premiere and do press.
Mm-hmm. Well, and by the way, there could be a sequel to A Fault in Our Stars, but that's another story. All joking aside, there could be very easily. If John Green wanted to make it happen or the studio wanted to make it happen, it could happen. And with $300 million worldwide, it just might. At number two around the world is the Liam Neeson action film, A Walk Among the Tombstones. That grossed $18 million. It opened in 10 territories. I'm a little surprised. Obviously, the others were, I think, pretty small. It opened number two in North America, a pretty weak opening compared to recent Liam Neeson action films. But it only cost $28 million to make. They'll be fine when all is said and done. At number three around the world is Lucy, the Luc Besson film. That's another $13 million as it begins to approach $400 million worldwide. At number four, a film that opened only in North America, This Is Where I Leave You, sort of a family comic drama with an all-star cast, I'd have to say, right? Pretty all-starry.
Yes.
Jason Bateman and so on. Another, you know, modest opener. It made $11 million, but it didn't cost a lot of money. It, you know, only cost $20 million to make. It's in a more adult film. They're not going to rush out their opening weekend. So this is a movie that they anticipate will have legs.
Well, I knew this movie was being released. It's the, as you say, the movie with Jane Fonda and Jason Bateman and Tina Fey. I would have gone to see it if I had known that it had opened.
Yeah, well, you know, you're older, right? We're not looking at the Maze Runner countdown clock. And so we're the type of people, oh, it's open. Maybe I should go. So, you know, that's why you go weekend two, weekend three, something
exactly.
Like that. At number five is Guardians of the Galaxy, another $10 million. It's at $630 million worldwide. And number six is Dolphin Tale 2, the sequel to Dolphin Tale. That's at $30 million worldwide. And number seven is No Good Deed. That's only open in one territory, another $10 million. It's at $40 million and counting. This is the film starring Idris Elba, correct? I got it wrong last time.
You know, I don't know whether it's Idris Elba or Idris Elba. That's what I was trying to say.
You've mispronounced
it possibly twice now.
Oh, no. Is it Idris Elba? Idris is what I said before? What an ass I am. I apologize, Mr. Elba. I'll just call you Mr. Elba from now on. How's that sound? That's a damsel in distress film. Goes $40 million. It's in North America. We'll have to see if they even bother to open it up overseas. Why leave money on the table? That's what I say. And number eight is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. That also made just about $10 million. That's at $330 million worldwide. Number nine, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. That's about to hit $700 million. At 10 is the Cameron Diaz sex comedy Sex Tape. That's at $108 million. And there's an opening down here. Number 12, One Step Away. This is a Chinese romantic thriller. It's about some sort of assassin guy who's supposed to kill a general, but then he sees the love of his life dancing with him, and they keep running into each other. They love each other, but their love is thwarted at every turn by circumstances. And that grossed $6 million. I assume it opened in China.
Well, I also see here at number 20, it looks like The Box Trolls has opened somewhere. This is the animated film from Laika.
That's right. It opened last week, I believe, overseas. It's in 11 territories. It grossed $4 million. It's now at $11 million and counting. Not very good reviews at all, but, you know, very talented people behind the film. It's a shame, but not every movie can succeed,
oh, that's right.
at least artistically.
That's right. We did talk about this last week.
That's right. So it's the second weekend overseas. It's at $11 million and counting. We'll have to see how it does when it opens here in North America. And of course, if I go see it, what I'd love to do is see it in the Barco Escape. Is that what it's called?
Oh, I was wondering how, after we talked about Maze Runner, how you were going to get back to Barco Escape. I was wondering. Yes, it's called Barco Escape. Barco is a digital cinema projector manufacturer. They produce display technology, not only for the motion picture industry, but for other industries as well.
And they've created a technology and a new thing that is a product looking for a customer. And I mean customer in both studios and audiences.
Yeah, I think you're probably right on that score. But, you know, they are figuring out new ways to use their technology, which is, you know, a projection technology, and ways to, well, in this case, extend the screen. So they have taken the main screen, which, and left it alone, that's still there, and they have extended the screen on the left and right by kind of adding a screen to the left side of the auditorium and another screen on the right side of the auditorium, where they can project different images that may extend what's happening on the main screen, or images that might coincide with what is going on in the main screen.
What could this possibly be for? You're telling me the screen extends out farther, almost immersive, sort of like the thing you'd see at Disney World where you were surrounded by a film in a circular room, but this isn't quite surrounding you, but it's far more immersive. It's like a 270-degree experience rather than whatever. What do you call it when you're just looking at a flat screen? I don't know what that is. 180? I guess.
Yeah,
I don't know.
It's just, I don't know. That's a good question.
Well, let's find out. But anyway, this is the screen extends both to your left and your right, and more images can appear there. The what images are supposed to appear there? What movie has extra images to show?
Well, no.
You're sure not going to stretch it out. So you have to shoot something new in order to put there. Well, who cares? What's the point?
Well, you know, it's funny that you should ask that, because I agree with you. If you just extend the images, then
you can't.
Yeah, it would look awful. And first off,
right, it's just like on TV when you mess up the aspect ratio and suddenly you get some stretched out weird thing. Everybody looks really tall or really short.
Yeah, so this is not like, unlike Cinerama, it's not just a big, giant, stretched out image. It is really, it extends what's going on screen.
It's asinine. Who's asking for this? Is anybody committed to making a movie with this stupid thing? What did they do for Maze Runner? It apparently on one screen somewhere, Maze Runner was shown in Barco Escape.
On one screen, on five screens. There was one in Chicago, outside Chicago, one in Florida, one in Los Angeles, one in the San Francisco area, Redwood City,
and Fox had and one in anticipated Texas. This and built and shot extra footage so that you could see more of the maze, I guess, or what the heck was in the image. I mean,
yeah, they created specific footage for the left and right screens, and there's only 7 minutes now. They're working on more footage for the film.
So you're watching the movie, and it's just like if you see a movie and there's 5 minutes in IMAX, you woo, here's the IMAX moment. This is the Barco Escape moment.
Correct.
Okay,
yes.
Who cares?
I have to say, I was a little dubious myself going into this.
Well, not dubious, it's ridiculous.
And it can work.
Anything can work, but it's stupid. For 99.99% of movies, there's no need for it, there's no point. It adds no exciting big new thrill. It's not a new way of seeing a movie. And you know, it's an afterthought from the filmmakers. There's no filmmaker saying, there are filmmakers calling for, you know, much better sound quality, much better picture image, bigger screens. Nobody's saying, God, I wish I could shoot in 270 degrees.
Well, I don't necessarily. I think that, again, all of this technology is a tool, and you have to apply it to the right film.
No, this is a gimmick for movie theaters that is stupid, that no artist has been asking for. If you're in black and white, people were going, God, I wish I could shoot in color. That happened. Nobody was asking for this gimmick. It's a dumb gimmick. The theaters that spent their money wasted their money. They have hundreds of thousands of dollars into retrofitting their theater, and they're fools for doing so. And anybody who pays extra is a fool, until and unless some idiotic filmmaker goes, I'm James Cameron and I want to make Avatar in 290 degrees.
Well, you know what? I would like to point out that 3D and all of these technologies, it does take a filmmaker like a James Cameron to come along and apply it properly. This is not, you can't just shoot a movie the same way you would any other movie.
There's no thing for this. There's no call for this. Yeah, 3D has been fiddled with for 80, 90 years. Nobody, you know, we've had this gimmick. We've had the screen that wraps around you, and you can go to a darn, you know, theme park and see that. And that's nice once in a blue moon, but there's no need for it on a regular basis.
Well, I'd have to disagree with you.
It's not a new idea that you have a screen more wrap around or completely wrap around. I went to Disney World. I saw that nature film. You're in the Grand Canyon. There you are. It's kind of neat. But do most movies need to be shown that way? Absolutely not.
Well, that I agree with.
And there's no reason for it. It's just a stupid gimmick.
What I would say is, without people attempting, and filmmakers and...
No! Some company came up with stupid technology. Now, well, we have to try and see if there's something interesting that can be done with it. Something interesting can be radically done with anything. That doesn't mean it should become the new standard, or that this is the way theater is going to progress and this is the way cinema projection needs to be. Like, they all have sound. They all have color. They are never all going to be 270 degrees or 360. It will never happen. It's stupid.
Well, I think that you, without...
It's stupid!
Hey, without...
You don't think it's stupid?
I think that you
are
need
you
to...
in that much of the pocket of exhibitors?
No, first of all, the exhibitors did not pay for this. This is a trial being run by Barco and 20th Century Fox. Okay, so nobody. So that's number one. Number two, I think that whether it's Escape, whether it's digital surround sound or Oro or Atmos, I think without trying these new things, even if they're gimmicks and even if...
Why can't you just look at it and go, you know what? Shaking the seat is stupid. You don't need to try that. That is stupid for movies. That is stupid. That is a theme park ride. It's not a movie. I'm not some purist. I like digital projection is fine. I wish it was, the quality of Sailor, blah, blah, blah. But sound is fine. Color is fine. Black and white is fine. IMAX screens are fine if you see a movie shot in IMAX and it's a real IMAX screen, not a ripoff, though it's not my first choice. 3D can be done well. But shaking your seat, putting fog in a theater, shoving the screen back a couple extra degrees, those are all stupid gimmicks. Those are just P.T. Barnum nonsense.
Well, I know. I mentioned ways for our readers to contact us at the head of the show. I guarantee, readers, listen to me. Our listeners can contact us. I know that some of you out there have seen this either in action or have thought about going to see Maze Runner in the Escape format. If you've seen it or are thinking about going to see it, let us know what you think of it. I thought it was better than 3D, quite honestly. I'm not, as you know, necessarily a big fan of every movie being in 3D. Certain movies are great.
I'm not a fan of any movie in 3D, frankly.
Certain movies are great in 3D. But in this case, I felt that it actually worked because Maze Runner is such a CG-heavy movie where the main characters spend a lot of time running through a maze of concrete walls where you could basically be playing a video game. It actually worked to make the audience feel a little bit more claustrophobic and have those images in our peripheral vision. I don't necessarily know whether, like, The Queen or,
or
12 Years a
Woody
Slave
Allen or something.
Yeah, it wouldn't work. So again, I think applied properly, it could work. I also think that the way theaters are set up today with stadium seating and not a sloped floor and two, the left and right walls being at 90 degree angles, that doesn't work. So retrofitting, there has to be a way to install this properly. There has to be a way to shoot this properly and create the proper type of content for it.
What's your best guess?
I think that somebody will come along. And by somebody, I mean a filmmaker who will actually learn how to use this technology. And it will be a special type of release. It won't be on every film. I think it will be on some films.
Really? You think it's going to catch on and become a permanent fixture in cinema exhibition? You think Barco Escape is going to become a regular thing that every 3, 4, 5, 6 months, there'll be a movie that comes out in Barco Escape? You think this is actually not a gimmick? You think it's a thing that is going to exist and continue?
Well, because it's not done yet, it's way too early to tell. But what I will tell you is what Barco is doing here, I think companies, whether it be Barco or others, will continue to do, which is they will continue to try and extend the medium and expand on the medium. And that's what's being done here. Much like I said in the piece that I wrote for Celluloid Junkie, watching a movie in Barco Escape is definitely you have to get used to it. It's not, it's like going to a Shakespeare play and your ear has to get used to that modern English.
Modern?
What, isn't that what it's called? Modern, that 16th century English or 17th century English where, you know, there's all the these and the thous and the thys. You know, your ear, it almost sounds like a foreign language until you get used to hearing it. The same thing is true watching a film this way. The first couple of minutes, you have to get used to the images being on the left and right.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Do I think it's going to take off for every film?
Is it the wave of the future? No, nobody thinks anything is for every film. Do you actually think this is going to be in hundreds of theater screens around the country, 1,000 screens, that they're going to retrofit 1,000 screens so they can show movies in Barco Escape? Because if it's not on 1,000 screens, it's never going to work.
I don't think they will do it in the way that they did for this trial. I think they're still working on it.
That's stupid. Anyway, New York Film Festival is showing Gone Girl, and I can't see it. Because I got a play that conflicts with the screening. It's very annoying. However, I'm a little confused because the New York Film Festival has just a handful of exclusives like Gone Girl, which is the new film by David Fincher starring Ben Affleck, and Inherent Vice, the film by Paul Thomas Anderson based on the Thomas Pynchon novel. I'm looking forward to that. And I would think you'd want to make it special like at other film festivals. You have to go and see it there. But in fact, Variety and Hollywood Reporter have already reviewed it. Doesn't that sort of take away from the excitement of the film festival? That the people sitting there for the first time aren't going to be seeing it, even the critics? You know, we're going to go there in a week, 10 days, and well, it's already been seen.
I knew that they were showing this. They showed it during the Toronto Film Festival, actually.
You mean to critics?
Yeah, down here in Los Angeles. I don't know why I said down here as if somehow everybody was up in Toronto and Toronto is up and Los Angeles and New York
are
down.
It's one thing, I guess, to let them, you know, see it and prepare their review. It's another thing to let them print their reviews before even the press screening.
Right. And I think that, who knows, maybe, you know, one person broke the embargo. So then.
They both came out simultaneously. Okay. I'm sure they did it. And Variety and Hollywood Reporter did it together. I'm sure it was permitted. There'd be an angry outcry saying, how dare you break the embargo?
Well, I know that some of the folks that saw it loved it. So maybe that's why they let them publish their reviews early to get people excited for the New York Film Festival screening.
Well, I think Variety was very strong and Hollywood Reporter was solid, but not a rave. Hollywood Reporter was okay. Like, oh, it's commercial, it's good, but it's kind of like, it doesn't feel like his passion's in it. But they respected it and thought it was commercial. But what struck me even more about the review was the review in Variety by Justin Chang said, quote, after the perceived commercial disappointment of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, despite an eventual worldwide haul of more than $230 million, .. I thought that was a little weird for a Variety review of a movie to talk about the perceived commercial disappointment. I mean, isn't it a commercial disappointment?
Well, probably, yeah. I would imagine.
It cost $90 million to make. It was based on a trilogy of books that had been a massive worldwide phenomenon, sold 75 million copies and counting. It was as red hot as a book property can get, practically. You know, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, everybody in the world was reading these books. They surely planned to make the two sequels of the two other books. They're dead in the water, and the movie didn't even, you know, gross 200, triple its budget.
Yeah, I think that's probably true there. I mean, I would have expected that movie to make $400 million easily.
Yeah, now, isn't that weird that Variety, of all places, you would expect them to be the ones that would be on top of industry numbers and things? And, you know, why would they? Are they playing a sop to Fincher, trying to make them feel good?
No, I think they're hedging their bets in, you know, having the studio give them a call and saying, hey, it wasn't a commercial disappointment. Look, here are the numbers. You know,
What number? Do you think they're going to open their books?
No.
It cost $100 million in North America and $130 million overseas. That means it grossed, they took back $50 million in North America and maybe $45 million from the rest of the world, at least at the box office. What's $95 million? It costs $90 million to make and a lot to market. And then the two sequels have fallen off the face of the earth. How is that anything other than a commercial disappointment?
Do they really
need to pussyfoot around and say perceived?
Well, given the fact that they have not even talked about making the other two movies in the trilogy,
yeah.
I think that you can take the word perceived out.
I mean, an angry phone call. Oh, well, maybe if they'd shot it in Barco Escape.
Yes, exactly. It would have been great. Now let me ask
you. The girl with the dragon tattoos stretching along.
With lots of O's. Oh.
Yeah.
Now, you said that this was a film, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, based on a series of books that sold 75 million copies.
So far, yeah.
And I think, wasn't it also, it sold like the most e-books ever originally?
It was the first e-book to sell 1 million copies on the Kindle.
Ah, that's what it was. Okay.
So, yeah, so it was the first to break that barrier via Amazon's particular there, of course, the dominant seller of ebooks. And it was the first one that they confirmed sold 1 million copies on the Kindle. You know, it had set many records, hugely popular and successful. It was supposed to be 10 books in a row. The author died. There were only three. Somebody else made a fourth book, I think. But, you know, there you go.
Somebody else made a fourth book. Let me finish that sentence. Nobody read it.
No, I don't know how it did. It may have done fine. But it was a publishing phenomenon.
Okay. Well, that was my way of actually moving us into the publishing news that you gathered up for us.
Well, tell us, Berlin, who is the biggest bookseller in the world?
Barnes and Amazon.
No, the number one.
Oh, Amazon. Amazon,
of course. Who is number two? Oh, who's the biggest ebook seller? I just told you.
That's right. Amazon.
And who's the number two ebook seller?
See, now I would have originally said, well, either Barnes & Noble or Apple, but you're about to tell me that it's Apple.
That's right. It's Apple. You know, nobody really knows.
What do you mean? Wait. So we're basically saying
it's kind of a secret.
We're about to tell you a story that may or may not be true.
Exactly. It's Barker Escape in facts. It's the facts stretch out to the end of the wall. Yes.
Oh my God. You know, you're not going to give up on that, are you?
And no. Amazon won't give us firm numbers. You know, they don't release firm numbers even to the publishers, though. I mean, they must on individual books, but they never leak out very well. Barnes & Noble and Apple, they keep their, you know, hands close to the vest. So it's really hard to tell actually what numbers are going on here. But most observers would say that Apple has moved past Barnes & Noble to become the number two ebook seller.
Hmm. Okay.
You know, so that's sort of interesting. Barnes & Noble, of course, is floundering a bit. At one point, we're trying to sell off their ebook division. They were trying to sell off. Somebody else wanted to buy their physical bookstores. So they're all in turmoil. And Apple has been quietly moving along. Now, I know when Apple launched their new iPhone and their Apple Watch, people in publishing, of course, everybody watches that event from their own lens. And people in publishing were very upset because Apple never mentioned books.
Well, what are you going to do? Read a book on your wrist?
Well, when they launched the tablet, books were a hugely important factor. Steve Jobs was like, we must have books on our tablet before we launch. We must have them ready to go. That was part of the big push and part of the big reason those deals were made and in the way they were made. And so that was part of the problem when the government came to investigate. But a lot of people read books on their phone, and the new iPhone is a phablet, really. It's somewhere between a phone and a tablet. It's bigger than the previous iPhones. And people in the book industry are like, this may be the best device ever for e-reading on the go. They think the screen is great. The size is great. You'll always have it with you, unlike perhaps your e-reader or your tablet. You know, you're going to have your iPhone with you. And they think it's a tremendously good platform for reading books. People already do it on their iPhone. Now they may do it even more with the new supersized iPhone, which they're not calling a phablet, you know, that little awkward jump up in size. But that's what it is. And they're really excited about it. So, you know, they were sorry that Apple didn't tout that fact.
Well, that's stupid. Just kidding.
And there's another reason. iOS 8, of course, was launched, you know, with to a bunch of people. The new update for their operating system went out to, like, I think 600, 700 million people, something like that.
Yeah.
You know, hundreds of millions of people have downloaded the new operating system from Apple. I did it myself. And for the first time, it came with iBooks pre-installed.
Well, now let me ask you this. They force you to download the U2 album, but the upgrade, the software upgrade, they kind of just say, hey, do you want to, they don't force that. That's an opt-in.
That's right. You did opt in. It took quite a while, but you know, it's gotten rave reviews. I don't know if you've played with it yet or if you like it.
I have not downloaded it yet because I have to get some photos off of my phone so that I can actually, you know, have enough room to, yes, exactly.
Well, doesn't it also go on your computer?
iOS 8?
Yeah, is it just for your phone?
It's just the phone. Well, right. It downloads to the computer to install onto the phone, but...
Oh, okay. So that means 650 million people worldwide will be installing Apple's ebook service onto their phones in the next few weeks. And if half of them are people who never had iBooks before, that's 350 million potential new customers. If 1% of them actually use it, that's 3 million new customers in the Apple Book ecosystem.
Well, they may be avoiding the subject given the lawsuits that occurred after the last time they talked about it at a keynote address.
No, I don't think that was it. I think it was just not a priority for them, but they're making up for lost ground. People are very excited by the iOS 8 software, and they're also excited because Apple's been pushing books worldwide. You know, they don't play, you know, country to country, city to city. They're playing a big game here. They've got dozens of titles, about 50 now, that are free to users. And they come from 39 different publishers. They're in 9 different languages. And so you're in France, you're in Germany, you're in Japan. They've got books in your language for you for free to get you using their system, signing up for it and see what it's like. You got books from James Patterson, fantasy bestselling author Brandon Sanderson, Sarah Shepard, who wrote the young adult series Pretty Little Liars, which got turned into a TV show. And what do those three authors have in common?
They're all with Hachette?
No, they're all authors whose books are part of a series. The books that they're offering, you're like, hey, here's book number one. Come back for more.
Well, Apple is not the only company, as we know, making ebook readers. Certainly, we've talked about Amazon. Barnes & Noble has their own ebook reader. And so does, Kobo is out there? Or is Kobo is not Barnes & Noble.
No. They're their own thing.
And just last week, Amazon announced another round of Kindle upgrades.
That's right. They've got new tablets, and they've also got new e-readers. The Kindle Voyage is now their new high-end model. It's got a new way of turning pages. It's got a great screen. The new internal lighting is even better. I'm jonesing for it. I would like it. I'm not ready to pay. My Kindle works just fine, but I kind of wish I had the internal light now, which has started with the Kindle White. And so this new one looks very interesting. They've also got a new basic Kindle, which is basically my Kindle Touch. So now their basic model is a little more expensive. I think it's like $80-$90.
Yes.
But it's much better than the earlier one that you had. So I was kind of hoping there'd be a free Kindle by now. I thought somebody would, you know, with ads and other stuff, I thought somebody would just want to give you a Kindle, or at least for $20 or something. But in fact, the price isn't falling much below $80-$90.
Well, I think that's what it costs to make, A. And B, I think that if Jeff Bezos started giving away Kindles, I think his shareholders, who have already punished him with the stock price, I think they'd be up in arms. But that's just my gut.
What's $2 billion in losses among friends?
Especially when you've made $20 billion in revenue, you know? It takes a lot to lose $2 billion when you have $20 billion in revenue.
Well, Barnes & Noble is also in the game. They're not making devices that are on their own, but with Galaxy, they released a new tablet that is optimized. I'm putting that in quotes for reading. It also costs about $200. It costs $180 to be exact, kind of like the Kindle Voyage, but it's a tablet, and it comes with $200 in free content. And Kobo, they've also got a new e-reader as well. It's called the Kobo Aura H2O because it's waterproof, and it costs $180. So there's a lot of new e-readers out there. E-readers seem to be falling by the wayside. People don't care about them as much. The tablet is taking over. I still love an e-reader. I think it's great for kids because they don't got 800 if you can afford it. You know, you can afford to give them an e-reader on its own. They're not going to be distracted by email and going online and surfing and playing a game. It's just an e-reader. So I still think that has a great advantage. It's powered up and it lasts for weeks or even months of reading, depending how often you use it. It's great for travel. I still think the e-reader has a place, but I may be in the minority. Now you've got your phone tablet and you've got your tablet and there's no need for that e-reader, but they're still there and people still want them. The Kindle was announced. Immediately, they've pushed back the release date because either demand is really high or supply is really low, but they're not able to make their target dates for the Kindles. So now instead of October, November, they're going to be sent to people in November and December.
Well, maybe the reason they're having so much trouble, and that is Amazon, maybe the reason Amazon is having so much trouble with their e-readers is because they're too busy planning these like gigantic events that Jeff Bezos can invite all of these authors to. Wait, what are you talking about? Why? What? I thought everybody knew about Campfire.
You're not supposed to. The first rule about Campfire is don't talk about Campfire.
Oh, I thought, well, the New York Times is talking about Campfire.
They are, and I'd never heard of it. Campfire is an annual gathering that Jeff Bezos has. He loves writers. And so he brings writers and other thinkers together for a big, like, long weekend. They all get, you know, swag bags of stuff. They're treated like kings and queens. Apparently, a lot of big names in publishing. It's not just people that Amazon published, but anybody and everybody that they like. They invite them. They get together. They schmooze. They have, you know, talks and conferences on this and that and the other thing. And they just sit around and talk about how wonderful they are, I guess. It's just a love fest. And it's a lot of fun, apparently. I'm sure, why wouldn't it be if a billionaire brings you in and says, hey, let's have a fun weekend together? together.
And I assume, Michael, that our invitations to this are probably still, what, they're in the mail, right?
I guess. Yeah. But the reason it made news this year, I guess, I hadn't noticed about it before, but the reason they talked about it was because people who had objected to Amazon, who'd been to Campfire in the past, somehow were not invited this year. So those authors that had been there before and he'd, you know, thought kindly of and would have normally brought back, not so much. So that's why it made news and people talked about it. Some people didn't want to go because they didn't want to be seen beholden to Amazon, like Hugh Howey, who's a big supporter of them. But he said, I don't want to go and have people think it was a quid pro quo. So that's why he didn't go, even though he was probably invited. And almost everyone they spoke to did not want to talk about it. They're like, shh. You're like, no. You're not supposed to talk it. Not supposed to mention it. Don't tweet about it. Don't Facebook about it. Nothing. It's supposed to be a private, you know, little thing that we all do and we love each other.
It's like a congressional junket.
That's right.
A lobbying
it sounds like it's a nice gesture, a nice thing to do. Too bad now it's been politicized, but we know why.
Yes. Well,
they're a big company and there's lots of tension.
Well, now you say tension, I say attention, which is what the National Book Awards brings to some of these authors who are, I guess, and they're on the short list or long list. I don't know. It seems like a short list.
This is the list, I think. I don't know. Maybe it's a long list. No, I guess they do shorten it because it's called a long list.
Yes, exactly. That's why I say that. And of course, the Man Booker Prize over in the UK, it's a £50,000 or $9 trillion prize. That's a foreign exchange.
I'm not sure. I think that's you may be off on your exchange rate, but yeah, we'll have to check into that.
I think it might be $81,000 in prize money. But I guess the Man Booker Prize, it used to be just for British-born authors, right? But now it's for all novels written in English and published in Britain, and not just writers from the Commonwealth and Ireland.
That's right. That's why there are two Americans on the shortlist. Joshua Ferris, who's a terrific writer. His new book, To Rise Again at a Decent Hour, is on the list, as is Karen J. Fowler for her book, We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves.
Now, that's what I wanted to ask you about some of these books, both the ones on the Man Booker Prize list and the ones on the National Book Awards list. You, of course, run bookfilter.com.
That's right.
So you're reading a lot of these books.
Well, I haven't read a lot of these yet. I would say the majority of them I haven't read. The ones I have, I really like a lot, most of them. Anthony Doerr, his book, All the Light We Cannot See, came out from Scribner and Simon & Schuster. That's on the long list for the National Book Awards. I like that book a great deal. I loved Jane Smiley's Some Luck. That's just a terrific book, the first in a trilogy. Hasn't come out yet, coming out in a few weeks. I've been raving about it to everybody. I can't wait to read part 2 and 3. I think that's just a really special book. It'll probably be her magnum opus, even more than 1,000 Acres, which won her the Pulitzer Prize. And I'm very excited to read some of the others, like Marilynne Robinson's new book, Lila, which is about to come out in a few weeks, and the great nonfiction books, too. I have not read any of them. You know, some years you have good luck and you've read a lot of them. Other years you haven't. But Walter Isaacson has a spinoff from his Steve Jobs bio called The Innovators. John Lahr has a biography of Tennessee Williams. Matthew Stewart has a good book about the early history of America called Nature's God, The Heretical Origins of the American Republic. So, you know, there's a lot of good books here. The only one I've read that I wasn't a big fan of was Richard Flanagan's The Narrow Road to the Deep North, which is sort of a World War II novel, if that's the right way to put it. That's been very admired and gotten a lot of great reviews, but didn't quite float my boat. But it is a great thing to do. You look at these lists, you find some books that you know. There's so many coming out, hundreds of thousands. Helps you narrow down your list and think of, hey, I want to read that book.
Right. And those were all on the National Book Award, which I assume will be announced before the end of the year. I know the Man Booker Prize will be announced before the end of the year as well.
I think of them, I think the Booker is still slightly more of a big deal because it really gives you a boost worldwide in sales.
Wait. Did you just say the Man Booker Prize is a big deal?
I did.
Well, then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, talked about overhyped. Well, I don't know if you could call this overhyped because you thought Time Warner had it bad just because Rupert Murdoch wanted to buy it. Now Sony is looking fragile. The multinational corporation lost $2 billion this fiscal year. Some investors are pushing the Japanese company to sell off the film studio, even though that's the one division that made a modest profit.
Not the WandaVision. It's WandaVision. I don't think it's the only one.
Okay. So I misread the writing there. You're right. It probably doesn't help, by the way, that the most recent Spidey movie, though profitable, was the least successful in the history of the franchise.
If only it had been shot in 270 degrees.
Oh my God. Hey, that could actually work.
Spidey would fly over there and back over there. People would turn their heads. It'd be a whole new way of seeing movies.
That actually, you know what, Michael, as much as you make fun of these technologies, there is one example of how it could work.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as usual, when a company loses $2 billion, there's going to be layoffs and cost cutting. But will the cutting include cutting out the making of movies for Sony? Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop.
What?
You know what? It seems like if companies make money, they fire employees. And if they lose money, they fire employees. So why do employees care? They're going to get fired anyway. Yes. No, they're under pressure to sell the film unit. I don't know if they should.
I don't think so.
I mean, what do we know? They're mostly a tech company, right?
Yes.
Is there a lot of synergy going on? I don't know.
Yeah. It was always odd, but I don't know who would want it, to be honest.
Well, I mean, Fox, presumably.
That's true. That's true. Absolutely true. Well, the blockbuster sitcom Friends is celebrating its 20th anniversary in style. There's the usual TV marathon, this time on TBS with fans choosing their favorite episodes. But in a more elaborate stunt, a pop-up replica of the show's coffee house, Central Perk. Get it? Because it's Central Park in New York. Central Perk. Get it, Michael?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, they're going to open one like a replica in Soho in New York City and serve 8 o'clock coffee to fans through mid-October. That's free coffee, people. Even the characters on the show didn't get free coffee. Come on.
Maybe Jennifer Aniston did.
Well, okay.
I think the guy at Central Perk probably gave her free coffee every once in a while.
Well,
didn't he always have a big crush on her?
I think so. Yes. Well, you know, anybody that shows up for free coffee can also check out the show's props and sit on a replica of the couch from the show's set. Big deal or big whoop.
Well, I think it's interesting, isn't it?
What? Wait, let me get this straight. Sony loses $2 billion, and it's a big whoop. You put, like, free coffee in Soho, New York, and all of a sudden it's,
well, it's not a big deal, but I'm interested in them spending the money to promote the 20th anniversary. I think it's cool, but it's a sign of how you want to keep a property fresh. You know, you don't see this a lot. People touting and doing some big stunt. Is it really more engineered by 8 o'clock coffee? Is it really being powered by the studio? Is it being powered by TBS? I'm not sure who's putting up the money and why. It's obviously still a very successful show in syndication. It's a valuable property, and you want to keep it active. And you don't see a lot of this, though. And maybe you'll see more of it as time goes on. They'll realize, hey, your library is alive, and you want to keep it pumped up and in the public's eye.
Right, exactly. You want to maintain it as a
viable, active presence.
Exactly. In pop culture. Because let me tell you, 20 years after the Mary Tyler Moore Show first aired, people weren't talking about the Mary Tyler Moore Show anymore. So people are still talking about... Well, okay. I know what you're about to say. But what I'm saying is it wasn't a part of the pop culture fabric the way Friends is today.
Well, I would say they're sort of in the same boat. I don't say that... I think Friends needs the boost as much as Mary Tyler Moore does. Friends still gets referenced every once in a while, just like Mary and her tossing her hat in the air would get referenced. And, you know, spunky little Mary. So I think, you know, they both are in the same boat. 20 years after they aired, hey, the show's been off the air for 10 or 15 years. People aren't talking about it every day. You need to do stuff to keep it up in the public's eye.
Okay.
But I'm just wondering if this is a trend that we'll see more of. People saying, hey, look, it's been 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. Let's do something to pump up the X-Files. Let's do something to pump up, you know, MASH. Let's do something to pump up whatever it might be.
There's a disturbance in the Force, Michael. No, not young Luke Skywalker, but the rabid fans of Star Wars, and more likely, the rabid owners of websites who want footage from the Star Wars sets to feature on their pages. The result? Drones are flying over the Pinewood Studios set where the new Star Wars movie is being shot. They're zooming in to show outdoor sets like a half-built Millennium Falcon and some X-Wing fighters. Disney anticipated this, though. In fact, they ordered some software that is supposed to give you an early warning notice of drones, and thus time to get out of sight, I guess. But for various reasons, that security measure hasn't been put in place. I'm not sure what the big deal is here, Michael. Everyone knows the Millennium Falcon is a piece of junk, even if it's the only ship to have made the Kessel Run in less than 12 parsecs. What do you think, Michael? Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal.
What?
I mean, well, because This is going to be a safety issue and a privacy issue. I don't think any company has ipso facto the right to declare all airspace theirs. But what the heck are we going to do? How long is it going to be before drones just hover over George Clooney's house? And, you know, George Clooney or my house, you know, what are we going to do? You know, where is privacy? Where does this end? What is the danger of all these drones hitting low-lying craft, hitting each other, crashing and hitting people? You know, you can't have 500 drones hovering over a set just to get some footage. So I don't know how this gets resolved for a safety reason and for a legal reason, but you would think businesses and people, even celebrities, are due certain privacy. And where, how are we going to draw the line? I don't know, but I think this is just going to become such a problem and someone's going to get hurt, or it's just become such a legal issue that we're going to have to resolve this in the courts somehow or with some new laws. I don't know what they should be. Maybe you know better, but it seems to me like a really big issue.
Well, hold on a second. I've got J.J. Abrams calling me. He called me earlier. He was really upset that his new Kindle didn't arrive on time. Amazon told him it would be there in 30 minutes. And of course, that is a reference to the Amazon drone delivery program, which has yet to actually surface.
Well, those years in the future. They didn't say it was about to happen.
That's true. Stevie Wonder is jumping on the Play Your Complete Classic album in concert bandwagon.
Yes, that's a big bandwagon.
Yes, exactly. The legendary artist, who is only 64 years old, by the way, is hitting the road, and he plans to perform his classic double album, Songs in the Key of Life, in its entirety. It was a crucial album in Wonder's career. He'd almost tossed in pop music altogether, despite massive success. But he signed the biggest contract in history with Motown, recorded this double album, and then became the first American artist to debut at number one on the Billboard charts. It was a huge commercial success, even though Wonder didn't even bother to release the popular Isn't She Lovely as a single. Now fans can hear it from start to finish on tour starting in November. Big deal or big whoop?
I guess it's a big whoop, though I'm excited and I'd love to go. And maybe as an encore, he can do Intervisions. Do another album as an encore.
Yeah, what do you do? There's like no more songs left.
Well, you know, it's such a big double album. It was a double album plus an extra EP. He had so much music. And of course, LPs were more constrained in what they could hold. He had to release one LP, a second LP, and then another EP shoved inside.
Wow.
And it's a great album. Elton John, who was the first artist to debut at number one on the Billboard charts, he beat Stevie Wonder to that record. He's always said, I always take a copy of Songs in the Key of Life with me everywhere. I never travel without Songs in the Key of Life. George Michael, a lot of artists will talk about this as a wildly influential album. It was his third album that he released in a row to win the best album of the year. You know, he was the king of the 70s in a way. He really dominated, you know, artistically and commercially. And this is probably the peak of his career.
What about the Jackson 5 or Michael Jackson? That would be the 80s, I suppose, right?
Michael Jackson was the 80s. The Jackson 5 were big hit makers in the
70s.
60s, early 70s, you know, they were certainly, but they weren't remotely as huge as Stevie Wonder as far as commercially and artistically.
When is a movie project not just a movie project? Well, I guess when you're in Hollywood and getting a movie made is more complicated than 3D chess. Example, the Bourne franchise. Star Matt Damon and director Paul Greengrass left the franchise despite it being the biggest hit of their careers because they felt the story had run its course. Or so they say. Now they're mulling a return, but all sorts of factors are in play here. Not just whether to make another Bourne movie. First, there's already another Bourne movie in the works. That's the spinoff sequel starring Jeremy Renner that is in pre-production and set for release in the summer of 2016.
Awkward.
Yes. But what? You're getting married tomorrow, but we have a date tonight. But Universal would much rather have Damon than Renner, so that film is in jeopardy.
Unless, they're not the only ones.
Yeah,
sorry.
Unless, of course, they decide there's Jason, you know, like a whole Jason Bourne universe a la the Marvel universe, and both projects can coexist. But why is Greengrass suddenly interested in Bourne again? Well, he's waiting for Fox to give a green light to his film about Richard Jewell and the Olympic bombing back in 1996. That film would take priority, and it's possible that getting ready to jump on the Bourne train will force Fox's hand. Plus, Stacey Snyder is coming to Fox and has a great relationship with Greengrass. On the other hand, Damon might really want to make Bourne since it's been by far the biggest hit of his solo career in recent projects like Elysium, Promised Land, We Bought a Zoo, The Monuments Men, and Contagion haven't set the world on fire. I love the fact that we call his career a solo career, like he's in a band.
Well, as opposed to the Oceans movie.
Oh, okay. Well, big deal or big whoop.
It's a big deal because it's not a big deal, but it's fascinating how it shows Hollywood in like a simple announcement, like, oh, they might make another Bourne film means like 18 ramifications for other people's careers, their careers, who wants to do it, why they want to do it. There's a lot of ego and points, and you're like Stacey Snyder going to Fox. She wants to make something happen. Matt Damon needing a hit. Paul Greengrass wants to make this other movie and needs to give them a kick in the pants. Say, hey, I could go make a Bourne film. So I think it's kind of hilarious how many ways this spins out and how many stories this one project can encompass. And I'll tell you, you look up Matt Damon on IMDb, the first thing that pops up is the Bourne Identity.
Well, a couple points here. One, Matt Damon dropped out of the Bourne franchise because Universal did not want to use Paul Greengrass as the director of the fourth film. So he said,
right, he stood by him. And I thought he also felt like, you know, they'd done everything they could with the guy. You know, he's still forgetful and, you know.
Yeah, he still can't remember who he is. Yeah. He couldn't remember 12 years ago. He still can't remember. There was that. And Stacey Snyder was no longer at Universal. She was at Universal when they hired Paul Greengrass to direct the second and third films. She wasn't at Universal when they decided to make the fourth film. So
I wasn't linking that, was I?
No, I am. I am right now as we speak.
Well, didn't she do other stuff at Greengrass too, or was it just the Bourne films?
I think she did United 93 or So that said, she's now over at Fox and apparently, you know, wants to work with the director she likes, one of them being Paul Greengrass.
Exactly. So, you know, she'll want to make that Olympic bombing project happen.
That's true. Now, 1090 deals is one bit of Hollywood lingo you can probably forget. The term refers to a TV deal. A channel pays for 10 episodes of a TV series, usually a lower cost comedy or half hour drama shot on a set. If the episodes hit a certain ratings target, the channel immediately orders 90 more episodes of the show, ensuring low cost by making them all at once and making enough episodes for the show's creators to what they call strip it in syndication. Tyler Perry has had big success with the approach, and FX mimicked it for shows starring George Lopez, Kelsey Grammer, and Charlie Sheen's Anger Management. All the shows hit their targets and went the full 1090, as they say. But they didn't go the full Monty and display real ratings power. Anger Management has been okay, but the others just so-so, and FX has decided this approach to producing TV shows probably isn't for them. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It's one channel deciding, yeah, we've been doing this a little bit. It's not quite working out for us. If somebody else doesn't, it pays off great. It'll make them excited to do it all over again. So I think it's a reasonable approach when you're looking at certain projects like sitcoms of a certain level and quality, then you say, hey, let's make a lot at once. You know, people renew shows for 2 seasons, 3 seasons in a row now. So, you know, I think it's an idea that can still have traction. I don't see there's any reason why it should disappear completely.
Yeah, I mean, it makes common sense that people would be more interested in a show early on in its run rather than later on, so that the latter 90 or the latter 50, let's say, would get lower ratings than the first 50. But
well, we got lots of counterintuitive examples, you know, like Law and Order peaking later on in its run and stuff like that.
That's true.
Shows could take a while to build. Who knows?
That's true. Now, recently, we told you how YouTube sensations are often considered bigger celebrities to young people than far more traditionally famous folk like, I don't know, Brad Pitt. Well, one comedy duo at the top of everyone's list of online hits is Smosh, the duo of Anthony Padilla and Ian, is it Hecox?
Peacocks? All right, it's up to you.
Okay. Maybe he and Idris or Idris.
Anthony and Ian.
Yeah, Anthony and Ian. They filmed their debut movie with Alex Winters of Bill and Ted directing, and it's just been picked up by Lionsgate. The story revolves around online videos, naturally. Anthony is about to attend his 5th high school reunion when an embarrassing video of him leaks online. 5 high school reunions. How many high school reunions can you possibly have?
I think they mean it's the 5th anniversary of his high school reunion.
Yeah, I think so too.
And isn't that sad how young that makes him?
Exactly. Much younger than, say, us. They tried to stop it from spreading, this viral video, so Anthony can still reunite with the girl of his dreams. Other online stars also appear in the film, like probably PewDiePie. Lionsgate is still deciding when and how to release the film, such as does it go straight to VOD, a theatrical release, a day and date release in theaters and online, and a whole bunch of other options. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal that they would even think about what to do. Why would you not release this movie in theaters? They have 30 million combined subscribers on YouTube. They have 19 million people following them on Twitter and Facebook and the like. They have 12 million unique monthly visitors. How How do you not put this out in a theater? I would want to get people to theater and not let them look at it. That makes it more special. Don't make it just like all the other online videos of the group that they can click and watch immediately. Make them go to a movie theater and pay money. You'll make a lot more. I think it's crazy.
Well, I think what's interesting is there that would be kind of relying on mainstream media, which is not how they actually made their mark.
What do you mean relying on mainstream media? They've built up their fan base. They've got tens of millions of fans. Now make it a big event. It's special. It's not special if you can watch it on your computer. That it's just like everything else they've done for the last few years. And so you want to make it special and stand out. And you can make more. I think you can make more money. You know, if you decide that, you know, you've released it and it didn't work, you can make a VOD a week later, you know, if you have to, right?
Yes.
I mean, how fast can you turn around VOD anyway?
Well, you know, it depends.
Or VOD or, you know, whatever. Yeah, it depends. But I assume that you can act pretty quickly and get it on there within 2 or 3 weeks. If for some reason it's a huge flop and you decide the best way to monetize it is to make it available cheaply online.
Well, you can if you want to annoy every single exhibitor on the face of the planet, and that's part of the problem.
Well, if it's already flops and outs, they're not going to care. Well, I mean, if it's day and date, you're going to limit your theatrical right away, aren't you?
That's true, yes.
Right, so I'm saying, don't you think it's worth putting on 800 screens, 1,000 screens?
Absolutely. You may as well, as they say, exploit the property as much as possible on all platforms.
Yeah, and I think, you know, they're so big, people want to make it an event, they want to make it special, you want to make it the Smosh movie, for God's sakes, make them go to the theater.
Yeah, I mean, granted, this is not like the material they've made in the past, which was for YouTube, but the material they made in the past was much shorter than an hour and a half or 2 hour movie. So given that it's different already, I think putting it in a theater or putting it on television is fine.
No, theater. I think they'll make a ton of money. I think it'd be crazy not to try and, you know, catch lightning in a bottle with these guys.
I agree. Now, we've talked about this next story a little bit this year about Time Warner Cable, which is here in the U.S., a cable operator. It's the second largest cable provider in the United States. Comcast, the first largest cable provider, wants to purchase them. They cut a deal with the Los Angeles Dodgers, a baseball team in Los Angeles. It's the Los Angeles baseball team.
Well, the Los Angeles Angels are in Anaheim, so you never know.
Yes, that's true. They keep trying to become a part of LA, even though they're south of the border, so to speak, in Anaheim. That said, they wanted to start a sports network, much like ESPN, and they were going to use the Dodgers to do so. They were going to create the YES Network, what the Yankees have, the New York Yankees have with the YES Network. So they cut this $8 billion deal with the Dodgers. It's, you know, for what, 20 years, $8 billion. And then they went to DirecTV and other cable providers and said, hey, if you want this new Dodgers channel, you'll have to pay us. You'll have to pay us $4.50 per subscriber per month. Well, the other cable providers said, wait a second. First of all, some of our subscribers don't even like or watch baseball. So why would we charge them $4.50 for a channel they don't even want? That's number one. Number two, we're not paying you $4.50 for anything, let alone a Dodgers channel. Well, what that meant was that for the entire baseball season, starting in April, the Dodgers in Los Angeles could only be viewed by 30% of the city's population, because 70% of the city is served by DirecTV or Verizon Fios or Dish TV. You know, so did the Dish
wasn't
network.
Even like a broadcast channel that carried it?
Nope, there wasn't.
You know, like there are YES games, there are Yankee games that are carried on like local Fox, local, you know, local Channel 11, blah, 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 nothing.
I don't want to say no for sure, but I think that most of the games did not get broadcast to 70% of the homes in Los Angeles.
So what changed?
What changed was this was a horrible PR mistake on Time Warner's part. Time Warner Cable's part. Sorry, Time Warner is a different company. This has been, for all season, this has basically, I think, lost the Dodgers fans. The Dodgers have done quite well this year. They are in first place. They are going to the playoffs. They will be in the postseason.
And you've made them invisible to half their three-quarters of the fan base.
That's correct. And now they are in kind of this pennant race with the San Francisco Giants, their arch nemesis from San Francisco. And they, during this week, so Time Warner Cable said, okay, we're going to air all of these games for free on Channel 56, KDOC TV. So they're basically making like a string of like five or six games available during this pennant race. But boy, is it too little too late. And I mean, it's the whole thing is just a nightmare.
I don't think they're much of a pennant race. I mean, they're leading their division by 4.5 games. Giants aren't going to catch up.
No, not anymore.
There's barely four games left. So they're very securely headed into the postseason. And yeah, you know what? You've just spent how many billions of dollars for this franchise? How much?
They spent $8.5 for a 20-year
for the TV rights to the team, and they immediately started off by isolating and alienating a bunch of their fans. Good move.
Yeah, and I think I can't remember who called the head of the FCC called for arbitration, like binding arbitration between DirecTV and Time Warner Cable, and DirecTV would not agree to it because they said we're not going to be held hostage if the arbitrator comes back and says, yeah, no, you should pay him $450. We don't want to be held hostage to that. We don't want to pay that much money for one sport, one team's channel. Period.
And it's something that a mayor or a governor might want to get involved in and try to resolve, but it doesn't seem like it could be a legal issue. You know, if they bought the rights to a TV rights for a baseball team and nobody else wants to pay the money they want to show it, there you go.
Well,
I don't know that the law can get involved.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I do think that when you have
I thought you had suggested that.
No, it's a legal monopoly, and you have to ask yourself about the issues happening here, given that cable networks have a geographic monopoly.
Okay, there you go.
That's why I think it's all a big deal.
Absolutely.
Well, Michael, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. As I mentioned, Mark Berman, the editor-in-chief of TV Media Insights, the online destination for television and media. I mentioned earlier he's going to be joining us. Berman has appeared on camera for Extra, Entertainment Tonight, Access Hollywood, the CBS Evening News, CNN, and way more. TV Media Insights has a daily email with overnight ratings, breaking stories, weekly analysis, late night updates, trivia, contests, and more, as well as a vibrant website community. Mark, thank you for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, Mark, I think of you as a ratings guru, and I'm not sure how that happened. People can go to tvmediainsights.com and see your website. They can subscribe to your newsletter. We'll provide that info. But how did this begin? Were you like a kid that would pore over network schedules and read Nielsen ratings like other kids looked at box scores on the sports page?
Oh, God, hell yes. I used to sit as a kid, and I would set up network schedules in terms of, what shows I put here, what competition. And then when I got a little older, I used to go into Manhattan to pick up my weekly edition of Variety. And I was completely involved in this whole business. As a little kid, I was always interested in this.
So then I guess now that you can, A, get Variety online and it's published once an hour, it seems like, and a lot of things have changed from having to go into the city to buy Variety on a weekly basis, including the ratings themselves. Last week, we had Les Moonves saying, hey, I don't think we should rely on overnight ratings. We should try and do what is called C+7. And now that's the only numbers they're going to publish. Can you tell us a little bit about what is going on in the ratings business these days, how it's changing?
Well, here's the obstacle that we all face. Now, my newsletter every morning, it goes out at about 10:30 Eastern time. So what I do every morning is I have the overnight numbers. For example, when you read the newsletter tomorrow morning, I will have the overnight numbers for the first night of the season, which is Monday. Now, I put out the numbers with the caveat that this is just a preliminary look at what to expect or potentially expect. Because after the overnights come out, you get the fast affiliate data, you get the live plus same day data. We have to then wait for the DVR data to be factored in. There are so many other facets to determining if something is working or it isn't. You have to be careful how you analyze it. You will also have to be very careful that the networks could very easily spin you to make something that isn't working look like a hit. And then you also have social media. It's not only about the traditional ratings, it's about who's tweeting, how much interest there is on social media. So there is a lot of different ways to look at this. But when I put out the newsletter, I put it out with the overnights, but that's your first look at for what to potentially expect. There's a lot more to it.
Now, to be clear, the caveat that you've added into your newsletter, that's a new feature. That's something new. You're like, you know what? I got to make clear now. So many people are watching on DVRs. Yeah. I got to make clear that this is just a snapshot.
Exactly. But you know what, though? Here's the deal. When the overnights come out, it's based on 56 markets. It's not the end all in terms of the numbers, but it's an idea of what you can expect. Because if you're getting a very low number in the overnights, chances are your numbers later throughout the day or the week are not going to be that much better. But you have to crunch it and look at it different ways. But you can't sit and wait for all the data to come in, because we work in a business of urgency, immediacy. So my job every morning is to get the information out as soon as possible so people can have a first glimpse of what to expect. But again, it's very, very tricky, because the networks can very easily spin you in terms of numbers. They could take something that maybe isn't doing well and make it sound like a hit. And people report it like that, so you have to be very careful.
Well, how do they do that? How does a network call you and give you some numbers and make it sound, no, this is what we were expecting, it's a big hit?
Oh, for example, you could have a show, the CW, for example, let's talk about that network. Now, traditionally, that's a network. You can't just look at the numbers on paper, because they have a much smaller base. So when you see an overnight number on the CW, you have to keep in mind that they really care about the young male demos. They really care about what have you. But what they've been doing over the last few years is they've been spinning the social media data about we're the most tweeted this, we have the most social media presence, we have this, we have that, but we never see the data. We don't know what the data is. They're just making a claim. You know, you can make anything sound good that isn't. There's so many different ways to look at it. And, you know, there's been a lot of conversation about we have to wait for all the data to come in. And in some ways, I feel like the networks are pointing the finger at me, because I'm putting out something every morning. I'm labeling shows winners and losers, but I do it with the caveat that there's other ways to look at things. So you have to be very careful. Another example, here's an example of something. The View on ABC opened its season last week. It was highly anticipated. We have a new co-hosting rotation. It got a lot of hype, and then ABC put out a press release the next morning touting it as the most seen season premiere in 8 years. Then we never heard another word from them the rest of the week. So what does that mean? You know, the networks only pick and choose what they want to tell you. They're not going to give you the whole picture. And it's my job to, you know, decipher everything and really call it as it is. But there's so many different ways to look at something that, you know, like tonight, for example, Gotham on Fox, that's debuting. Now, I think it's going to do very well. But traditionally, it's not a show like a CBS show that's going to bring in 13, 14, 15 million viewers. There's other ways to look at it. But the networks can kind of trick, you know, they can play games and manipulate the numbers. You have to be very careful when you analyze this stuff.
Well, now you say that the networks sort of, they sort of get annoyed because you're reporting things right away overnight, but that's numbers that they give you. You know, if they waited a week before releasing any numbers, and that's what some cable channels are claiming they're going to do now, they're just going to say, hey, look, we're not going to release any info until we've got the live plus three or the live plus seven. You know, if that's what they waited for, then that's what you would work with.
They can't do it. They can't do it because, again, we work in the business of immediacy. You can't sit and wait a week. We can't, for example, Gotham can't premiere tonight, and then we don't know anything for a week. People want to know. The advertisers want to know. The public wants to know. You have to report it as it comes in. I know, per se, that when you look at the overnights, we're talking about household overnights. We're not talking about the demos. So the way you have to look at it is, how did a show like that do in the key young demos? That's what Fox cares about. That's what the broadcasters care about. But you can't sit and wait a week or so to put out numbers. You have to release them. Do it with the understanding that this doesn't include DVR usage, it doesn't include this. And then, of course, another obstacle, which is a very big obstacle, you have a tremendous growing impact into the digital world. You have so many other places, Netflix and Hulu and everybody else is doing stuff. We don't know how many of these shows are doing. It's all speculation. There's no data. So you have to be very careful about that, how you report that. You know, a show like House of Cards, everyone considers it to be a tremendous hit. We don't know that. We don't see data. So it's a very tricky business. It's a very tricky game. And, you know, for a brief moment, I thought to myself, should I be labeling shows the morning after? Or should I wait until everything comes in? And for that fleeting moment, once it passed, I said, I'm still doing it the way I do it. Because that's what people want to know. That's what they want to hear. That's what they want to, you know, they want to read this stuff.
Well, what's a good example of a show that looked like it was perhaps not a big success, but once you looked at the live plus seven data, you can say, you know what, the show is a winner. Like,
well,
Here's an example.
You have a show like Constantine on NBC, Friday night at 10 o'clock. This is a show based on a comic book superhero. It leads out of Grimm. Now, chances are, on paper, the numbers are not going to look good because the standard audience that's going to watch that, they're not necessarily going to be home on a Friday night. So you have to keep that in mind when you're crunching numbers. So you have to really look at the DVR usage for a show like Constantine. You also have to remember that the smaller the audience initially, the greater the chance that the DVR percentage is going to be higher. You know, you have to keep that in mind because it's tricky. It's tricky. If your show, for example, if you do 10 million viewers and you bring in another 3 million viewers in DVR usage, that's 30%. But if your show that does 5 million viewers and you bring in 3 million in DVR usage, that's another 67%. So you have to be very careful.
Well, is it the number that matters, the total number of viewers? I mean, rather than getting worried about percentage increases and decreases and previous things, like how many people watched?
Well, that's, you know, look, we want to know how many people watch, but the real pivotal ingredient is the demographics. The broadcasters care about young demographics. They don't care about older viewers. You have a show last night, Madam Secretary, that premiered on CBS. I'm waiting at the moment for the total viewer base. Now, chances are it's going to be about 14 million viewers. That's a very, very solid start. But the demo only looks like it's going to be about a 1.9, which means that as the weeks progress, that 1.9 is going to turn into a 1.3 or a 1.4. So that's not necessarily a good number.
1.4 of what?
Of 1834, 18 to 49?
18 to 49. You have to remember that the networks care about the young demos. They care about 18 to 49. They care about 18 to 34. They don't care about 50-plus. They don't value those viewers, which to me is insane.
So why play their game? Why not emphasize more what you think is important? What I think is important is total viewers, whether they're 30 or 50 or 60.
I call it as I see it. And here's an example of a show that was prematurely canceled that really, really personally aggravated me.
Kathy Bates.
You had a show called Harry's Law on NBC. Remember that
absolutely.
Show?
Absolutely. It was ridiculous. I couldn't believe no one else picked it up.
It was doing about 8 million viewers on a Sunday night for NBC, which was very, very respectable. But the 18 to 49 rating was only about a 1 or 1.1, so it was bringing in older viewers. NBC didn't want it. That's a big mistake, because once you're past the 50 mark, your kids are grown, they're out of the house, you're on your own, suddenly you have money to spend. Although I don't, but most people do when you're in that age group.
Well, let me ask you this. It used to be that you got paid for the number of viewers that saw your show when it aired. Now, with C+7 and C+3, first off, I guess my question is, what does the C stand for? And the second thing is, what are networks and cable networks getting paid for? Is it C+3? Was it C+7? What have they been able to get out of there?
It depends on how these shows are being sold. It depends on the deals that are being made. It really varies. A show on CBS is going to be very different than a show on a cable network. It's a very different base. It depends on how the deals are being made. You have a show like NCIS on CBS that's going to bring in 18, 19 million viewers, maybe even 20 million. But the 18 to 49 rating will probably only be in the low 4 range, which is still a good number. But then you have a show like The Voice on NBC that's going to bring in a high demo with a much smaller audience base. So it really depends on how everything is being sold. And here's another trick. You have a network like Sci-Fi that last summer debuted a little movie called Sharknado. On paper, it did 1.3 million viewers, which was an average number. But in terms of social media, it exploded. It was the most tweeted. So the question is, how do we now sell these programs? Is there a way to sell it off of social media? So there's so many more facets to this. It's so much more multi-layered than it has been in the past. And you have to be very careful. You have to, how you crunch numbers and how you're gonna report things. But for example, here's another example. I'll throw this at you. Last week, Fox debuted Red Band Society. Okay. They promoted it all summer. In my professional opinion, I think the opening numbers were very disappointing, because you have to remember that most new shows in the second drop 10 to 20%. Then it drops about another 30% in week three, and there wasn't all original competition on last week. On the flip side, it held the lead-in from Hell's Kitchen. So they'll spin it that way and talk about how it held the lead-in, not focus on anything else. There are so many ways to, you know, determine what's working and what isn't working. It's very, you know, you have to be very, it's very tricky. It's tricky.
Mm-hmm. And what does the C stand for?
What does what stand for?
The C in C plus 7 or the C3, C7.
Oh, boy. I could answer that, really, if this was an X-rated thing, which it's not. I honestly don't know what it stands for. That's a good question. I'm not really sure. I won't, you know, this is a G-rated interview, so I won't say, but I don't know. That's a good question. That's a good question. Don't know.
Well, here's another big overview of ratings that we've talked about with Bill Carter of the New York Times, and that's sort of this false divide between the big four networks and the cable channels. When you look at weekly ratings and the top 10 shows and the top 20 shows, there's this artificial divide that has existed for so long between a show that airs on ABC and a show on AMC or ESPN or HBO. How can we not break down that wall and just get, you know, you talk about how you got to wait for the, you know, the live plus 7 ratings before you make up your mind. But oftentimes I don't see those reported well. And I certainly don't see shows on cable compared to, I'd love to just see. Tell me the top 50 shows, all the shows, list them in order every week. You know, I don't mind if I have to wait 10 days to find out. I want to know what the top 100 shows are. I don't care what channel they air on.
Well, here's the problem with cable. Here's the obstacle with cable. Now, first of all, remember, cable's a different world, because on a cable network, let's say TNT, they don't have to run 22 hours of original programming like a CBS or an NBC does.
But if The Walking Dead reaches 18 million people, that should be the number two or three show of the week. It's not in its own separate world.
But after all these years of doing what I do, I still do not have immediate access to the cable overnights. And the only thing they will send me is their highlights in terms of how their shows are doing. They're never going to say anything bad. They're only going to tell. Nothing's negative. And then later in the day, I get a cable ranking report listing everything in order of total viewers and adults 18 to 49. And then I get a weekly report. So it's a very, very different world. But the one show that has kind of narrowed the gap is The Walking Dead on AMC, because it's such a huge hit. It stacks up next to the broadcast networks. It's beating everything on the broadcast networks. Whereas, you know, a cable show that does 5 million viewers is considered a big hit. You have a show like The Walking Dead that's bringing in a network number. So that really has kind of changed the equation a bit. But it's a very different universe, cable versus broadcast. It's still very different, and it's going to stay like that. It's going to remain like that. And again, look at a network like AMC. They have how many original shows? You could count them in one hand, or scripted shows. Whereas you have an ABC that has to really fill 22 hours. It's a whole different ballgame.
It is a different ballgame. So you're telling me you just don't have access to the data. Quite simply, unless you're an advertiser and you pay a lot of money, you're simply not going to know what the ratings are?
Right. I can't. Well, first of all, you know, when I crunch the overnights on the broadcast networks, that's 5 networks. I couldn't. I mean, there's so many different cable networks. I'd be sitting at my desk till God knows how long crunching. I don't have access to the data. I don't get it. I did get an overnight report from one of the cable networks. They stopped sending it to me, and everything's under wraps. Everything's secret. And something will debut on a cable network. For example, it'll run tonight, and we won't know how it did until the following day, late afternoon. And that comes from their spin machine. They're going to tout, you know, what's good about it, and never say what's bad. And unfortunately, so many people out there take these press releases and publish them, and they're not analyzing them. So a lot of the information reported out there is not valid.
Well, there are a number of shows that are, you say that tonight is the first night of the season, and there are a number of shows that are premiering tonight and throughout the rest of the week and rest of the month.
Yeah.
Is there anything in the new television season here, even though television seasons are kind of being blurred these days, anything new that we should be looking forward to or that you're looking forward to, and are there any trends that you would point out?
Well, the biggest trend, without a doubt, and you know what I'm going to say, it's comic book superheroes. I mean, there's so much of this. CBS just announced They're going to do a soup. They're going to do a Supergirl. We have Gotham tonight. We have The Flash on the CW. We have Constantine on NBC. We have Arrow coming back. You know, there's so many of these superhero shows. That's the biggest trend of the season, is these action-adventure superheroes. But it's interesting. It's interesting. If I had to pick one show, there's 24 new network shows premiering. The one show that will absolutely succeed, it can't miss, but it's not a show that's going to get a lot of buzz, and that is NCIS New Orleans. It can't, because here's the situation. It's out of NCIS. It's into Person of Interest. It can't miss, but it's not the kind of a show that's going to get a lot of attention, which has always been the problem on CBS. They don't have those, you know, the attention-getting type shows. So without a doubt, the one new show that can't miss is NCIS New Orleans. I think Gotham has a very good shot. It's gotten a lot of buzz. I think a show like Gotham, when we go to Comic-Con in New York, it's going to be through the roof. I think The Flash on the CW can't miss, because it'll have the same audience as Arrow, which for the CW is very sufficient. So the three new shows I think can't miss: NCIS New Orleans, Gotham, and The Flash. And they're all it's all different. It's kind of, you know, New Orleans will have a much, much bigger audience, but New Orleans will not get the buzz that these other two shows will get. That's just the nature of that type of a program. So those are the three immediate shows that I think will get attention. One show that I really like, and, you know, on paper, the numbers are, excuse my language, the numbers are going to suck, is Jane the Virgin. I thought the pilot was very clever. Very unique for the CW, but very different for the CW. So this is a show that they're going to have to be patient with if they want this to stay on the air. And I think they probably will be. Then another show that I think has a really good shot is NBC sitcom Marry Me. And the reason for that, it's very simple. It's leading out The Voice. I think The Voice is still going to do very well. And lead-in is still very important. People say lead-in doesn't matter. That's bullshit. It does matter. Lead-in is very important. So if you're a sitcom called Marry Me out of The Voice, you're going to do much better than A to Z on Thursday night out of Bad Judge. So that's another new show that I think is going to succeed. But without a doubt, the theme of note is the superheroes. And like every season, we will have more flops than hits. Without a doubt, a lot of these new shows are going to tank.
Well, you know, that's absolutely true. And have we reached a saturation point as far as talent? We know that throughout the year of 2015, we're probably going to see more than 300 scripted shows debut on network and cable television. I mean, is there enough talent to create these shows? I mean, we talk about a golden age, but there's got to be a lot of hard shows to make, especially in comedy. It's hard to make a good comedy, and the talent is spread really thin.
Well, I have to tell you, I really have to say, this is a very good era for television. We have a lot of good shows on the air. We really do. If you look at their Emmy Awards, you know, recently, there's a lot of good product on the air. Much of that product is on cable, however, or is on, you know, Netflix. So it's not necessarily on the broadcast networks. But I think this is a very good time for television. You know, there really is a lot of good scripted fare. And remember, when you do a scripted show on cable versus a broadcast network, the rules are different. You know, you don't have to do as many episodes, which means more attention is given to detail. You have less restrictions on cable. So it's easier on cable if you're on HBO, where you automatically have that quality label. You have a show like The Blacklist on NBC that had a tremendous first season and didn't get any nominations. You know, it's simply because, you know, the sexy, exciting shows, you know, tend to be more on cable. The broadcast networks kind of are not really getting an equal attention in that area. But there's definitely stuff this season that's going to work, and there's definitely going to be a lot of stuff that's not going to work. I also think, on a positive note, I would give a thumbs up to How to Get Away with Murder on ABC from Shonda Rhimes. I think it fits well out of Scandal. And I think once Thursday Night Football ends, it'll have an opportunity. And I think that's a show that's probably going to stick also.
Well, Mark Berman from TVMediaInsights.com, thank you very much for taking the time to join us, not only to talk about this new television seasons and all the shows that will be debuting starting tonight, but also about what's changing in the world of television ratings.
I'm happy to be here. I would look forward to coming back. There's a lot to talk about. It's an endless conversation.
That is very true. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Well, it was great of him to stop by. The only show that he talked about as being a success that I would put an asterisk by is The Flash, because it was such a bad pilot. I thought it was really weak. No doubt it will sample well and do well. It'll probably run for at least a year or two just from momentum and the lead-in and all that, but I don't know if it will be a long-term success. And I would just tell the networks, if I were them, I just would not release information. You know, they're sort of beholden for the info. You know what? Wait a week.
Yeah, but once you release information, once you do that, it's very hard to say, no, we're not going to be telling you this anymore.
No, you are going to tell them. You are going to tell them. As a CBS exec said, is it David Poltrak? He's their chief research officer, and he compared evaluating a show's performance on overnight numbers to, quote, reporting the results of a baseball game after the fifth inning.
That's
now,
terrifying.
I love baseball, and I do check the scores during a game sometimes if I'm really into it and paying attention. But you know what? You really want to know the final score, and it doesn't really help your business to release 18 different little tweets about the third inning, the fourth inning, the fifth inning. The thing people remember is tell them the final score, tell them what it is. And that's absolutely true. You say, well, you've got to report it. You've got to tell them. It's not over yet. People are still watching the show. You can't tell them the numbers because it doesn't exist yet. Wait for the week, and then you know what? People will survive. And if that's the info you provide, that much bigger number of C+7, that's the number they'll report. And you know what? Everybody else will follow suit because they'll say, you know what? We look stupid. We look weak. They've got an extra 3 million, 5 million, 8 million viewers that they're boasting about. And nobody remembers what our C+7 numbers are because we tell them what the overnights are. And they can estimate and guess because that's what CBS's plan is. Well, we're going to guess what we think our C+7. No.
You know what else is guessed when it's
now
reported?
It's a bunch of nonsense. What?
The box office, the weekend box office are based on estimates, as you know, Michael, and
we get
the actuals usually Monday evening or Tuesday morning.
Well, we get a much stronger estimate on the weekend box office, like Sunday afternoon, Monday morning. They start on Friday, and their estimates are usually within a couple million dollars of each other. They rarely trend away, but that's a very easy to define area and a lot easier to track and predict. Television, because of the DVR, there's a lot of changing formulas and a lot of changing ways that people watch TV. And every year it keeps changing. And if you have a show that's been on for 5 years, you probably have a good idea what the C+7 ratings will be. But these new shows, that's a shot in the dark. They really don't know. And so, and you also have to take into account, as CBS says they will, what show did it air against? Was there a special event? Was there a big finale of some other show or an award show or a sporting event? You know, they're like going to go up and down based on the environment around that show. Well, now you're really getting crazy. You know what? Wait a week. Like you say, it's the fifth inning. You don't know what the numbers are. Just wait and then tell them when you know.
Well, you know, some people just can't wait. And some people will never know what the ratings are because they have passed away, unfortunately.
That's true. Actress Polly Bergen died. I believe she was an Emmy and Tony nominee. I think that's right. She was well-known, I think, at the end for TV's Desperate Housewives. She was also on the big miniseries The Winds of War and War of Remembrance. Those were huge, massive, epic miniseries. She co-starred in that with Robert Mitchum, who was also her co-star in the film Cape Fear, that classic thriller. So she was a stalwart who was, you know, on TV and stage and screen for many years. Never had a really big film career, but what I loved about her obit, we've got a link in our show notes, is how she branded herself. She branded herself. You think about all this stuff happening just today where actresses put out cookbooks and jewelry. No, it's been going on a long time. Celebrities have been doing it probably since celebrities began. And Polly Bergen had the Polly Bergen makeup, which she ended up selling to Fabergé. Polly Bergen jewelry, Polly Bergen shoes. I mean, she wasn't that big a star. I don't know how she did it, but she made a lot of money off of it and was very successful as an entrepreneur. So it's kind of cool. By the way, I think I'm wrong. She actually did win an Emmy Award. She won it in 1958 for playing Helen Morgan, the singer. So good for her.
Well, last week we talked about Joan Rivers passing away. Of course, a lot of people have been talking about that. I found this story fascinating, this next one, that Joan Rivers was promoting the iPhone 6. A posthumous Facebook post was published on, I think it was Friday or sometime last week. In which she says, this badass is being replaced by an iPhone 6. And I guess it was a picture of her old iPhone. She says, I got this one in 2010, and after 4 years, my only complaint is that apps are now designed for bigger screens, and the battery is getting tired. Never had a case for it since it was the most beautiful on its own. great achievement in design, great product. And I thought, wait a second, she obviously cut some deal with Apple to do
this. Well, that's natural, and she, you know, that's hilarious.
And it was put in. Yeah, it was put in to post.
I wonder if they remembered or whether they didn't care or they wanted, you know, it's a good question, whether they knew and thought they should pull it or whether they just, it was automated and they forgot or whether they're like, no, go ahead, it's cool.
It just goes to show you, don't believe everything you read, because in this case, she was, you know, it
she probably had it. She was ready to do it. It wasn't a lie.
Yeah, probably.
She says she's being replaced by a new iPhone. I'm sure she was going to get a new one. She got it in 2010. It's been 4 years. It's not a lie.
Well, it also goes to show you that, you know, everybody says, oh, the leaks coming out of Apple. You know, we know what the products are now before they launch. There's so many leaks now that Steve Jobs is not there. Well, yeah, when you're actually telling celebrities like Joan Rivers about your phones and having them tweet about it or schedule posts on Facebook, yes, people will find out about your products.
Okay. I don't know if she had any actual details. It just says it's being replaced. So, I mean, it wasn't a secret that it was coming out.
No, that's true.
But anyway.
Anyway. Well, if you want to contact us, again, you can do so. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. Our phone number is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, you can subscribe to our show, and we urge you to do so in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, wherever they give podcasts away for free, wherever they aggregate podcasts. That's usually where we can be found, and we do urge you to rate and review the show in those places. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as all those ways to subscribe to the show or contact us, can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways to follow us on Twitter, where our username is @showbizsandbox. And you can, of course, like us on Facebook. Our page can be found at facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Again, all this information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Again, thank you to Mark Berman from TV Media Insights. He can be found at tvmediainsights.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new. What is it this week, Michael?
It's iwantogotocampfire.com.
Listen to the middle of the show to find out what Michael is referring to. If you can't find Michael at Campfire, try, I don't know, michaelgiltz.com or bookfilter.com. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.